All right, last week, if you were here, we finished up the material in Luke chapter 22. This is where Jesus was once again readying his disciples for the fact that he was going to die and they were going to be on their own. He said in the past, you didn't have to have things like a sword, you didn't have to have things like a traveling bag, you didn't have to have things like money. But very soon, all this is going to change. I'm not going to be with you anymore. The Holy Spirit, as we'll see in John 14 through 17, was going to come. And the Lord said things are going to change and change drastically. It was also in verses 31 and 32 where we ended that discussion. Jesus said, if you don't have a sword, they said, here are two swords. And then Jesus acknowledged those weapons and said, it's enough. And as we mentioned, there are different interpretations as far as what that means. And we did spend some time looking at the question, is a Christian authorized to defend himself or herself if there is danger to the life of a Christian or the life of another innocent bystander? We got through that study, but we didn't have time to let anybody ask a question or make a comment. So I promised last Wednesday that if you wanted to do that, we would make that opportunity available tonight. So it's tonight. So is there somebody that wants to take a stab at that before we continue on with the events that happen, pulling now from Matthew 26? Okay, Trace.
I'll be the troublemaker.
All right.
Last Wednesday night, you gave several options as to what that could have meant. But you never said what you thought that meant.
Well, shame on the teacher. You know, it's difficult when you teach a passage that can be looked at in a variety of ways, and you're not dealing with a doctrinal issue. And that's really what you have here. I always try to be mindful of that. For example, it's a little bit like if you discuss the war question. Can a Christian fight in combat? You can argue that both sides. I have preached on that here, as well as Fort Wayne. And when I dealt with that, I tried to deal with it fairly. I tried to say, here is the pro-pacifist view, here is the pro-combat view, and deal with them equally. But you know, no matter how hard you try, if you favor one view or the other, it's very difficult to be, you know, perfectly equal because you're naturally inclined to lean towards one. So when I look at this particular topic, I admit that I do have a little bit of bias going into it, and I would opt for the self-defense view. That is a view. I mean, Jesus, the Holy Spirit was going to come, but there were also going to be times where they were going to need that weapon, maybe not for self-defense against a person, but against an animal, you know, maybe using that out in the trail and so forth. So I do believe that he authorized weaponry. But again, you know, coming from the background that I have, I'm a little more predisposed to that view, but in trying to work through the text, I do think that is the correct understanding of the text.
What's the possibility there's an option that we didn't explore? And that is when you look at what the outcome of that situation was, and that is that Peter cut off the ear of this man, and then Jesus healed it. Maybe that was the whole purpose behind it, and that was to point out, again, after many, many, many times, that he had the power to do such a thing. That might explain why he said two was enough, when in actuality, one would have been enough.
Yeah. We do know that God's kingdom is not an earthly setup. And we do know that Jesus, in that context, said that they live by the sword shall perish by the sword. So it's not like ISIS that's out there right now trying to force its way and say either convert or we're going to behead you. Those kinds of things. That's certainly not the way of Christ. But there is also, as far as I can tell, no obligation to let somebody come up and just chop your head off because they don't like Christianity. And you are forbidden from, you know, acting in some kind of reasonable way as far as self-defense. That's not the same context as when Jesus said, if he smites you on the one cheek, let him smite you on the other. So, anybody else? Don?
Last Wednesday you gave some passages from the Old Testament. Intruder in the daytime, intruder in the nighttime. At night, they're allowed to kill. In the morning, daytime,
for a thief, right. Kill. Right.
Now, did you give that just as a reference and not any weight to support one view or the other?
I gave that, yes, to just say if a person has any questions about, does the Bible ever talk about self-defense? That would be one of my passages back there in the book of Exodus, that here you have somebody breaking in at night. In this case, it turns out to be a thief, but you don't know that. And God said if self-defense is used, if you end up killing the person at night, you are not blameworthy. But during the day, the implication being you can see that the guy is carrying off your TV or whatever, there is no personal threat to you. God said if you kill him in that set of circumstances, then that's not authorized. But in the situation where it was night, they didn't have the kind of electric that we have, you know, maybe even couldn't get on a light. If he died, then God says you're not going to be faulted.
So that you're quoting those scriptures, and that would be one case where the Old Testament would have weight on your actions.
I would at least bear that in mind as far as the overall discussion on that topic, because here you have a life that was taken, no doubt about that. Here you have a life that's taken, and God says, you're guiltless, you're not worthy of any blame. That's also a fact. And you have a crime in progress that could have, because it's night, you don't know exactly what's taking place. In this case, the guy is a thief. But coming into your house at night, in that set of circumstances, God says, deadly force, lethal force is authorized. So, just to put that in the mix. And then when you look at the New Testament passages that we talked about, you know, you have some additional information there that you consider. So not everybody may want to make that choice. And I do think I want to make this additional point as well. When you think about defending yourself, do you have to kill somebody to defend yourself?
No.
In fact, after class last week, somebody yanked out of their pocket some pepper spray and said, look what I carry. Now, I'm not sure that that is the only person here that carries pepper spray, but I can tell you there's at least one. I can also tell you that about 10 years ago, we had a threat here. I was working some late nights, sometimes leaving the building at 7:30 at night. And there were times where it was just about dark outside. And, you know, even if you got the lights on out there, still, you just never know. And I did carry pepper spray on a keychain for a while. Never carried a gun. But, again, I thought that it was prudent because of a circumstance that we had to do that. It's often been said that if you need to defend yourself, you can use just about anything. There was a case within the last couple weeks here in Elkhart County. There was a fella, he apparently picked up a knife from the homeowner, came in, was standing over her bed with the knife. She kind of got that something is not right feeling, opened her eyes, and here's this guy there. And she picked up a lamp from the nightstand and started to bash the guy. Well, you know, bedside lamp can work. I've got a neighbor, a former neighbor. She moved out a few months ago, but she carried a baseball bat. With her, kept a baseball bat. And you know, not everybody wants to be knocked in the head or knocked in the kneecaps. And some other things. For example, if we ever had a perpetrator here at the building, you know, somebody might grab a fire extinguisher. Now, those are not exactly light. I'm not sure that you'd want to try to, you know, pick up maybe a 30-pound or 20-pound fire extinguisher and whack somebody on the head. Or might not be able to do that. But most people can pick up an extinguisher, pull the pin, and gas the guy. You know, you can fog them. That's probably not going to blind them for good, and yeah, that's probably going to stun them enough where some other people can respond. So when you think about defending yourself, don't walk away from that class thinking, I've got to have a gun, and I've got to shoot them, and I've got to make sure that they're dead. There are a number of ways to defend yourself, and not all of those involve lethal force. But biblically, again, from my perspective, going back to Teresa's question, I would argue that it is authorized if such is necessary. All right, does that wrap it up?
In the Old Testament, I mean, I'm talking about war. They fought all the time.
Yes.
And God would be with them.
Yeah.
So if it was too long, he wouldn't be with them.
Yeah. There again, you have to make that point. The one problem that we have, though, today is, how do you know that a war is just, or how do you know that a war is consistent with God's will? Yeah.
So they could heat up the English Channel. He'd come through Paris and walk through all this little country, got to Paris. And if we hadn't got over there and stopped it, he would have been
sure.
Here.
And you can make that same point about ISIS. You've got children being beheaded.
Yes.
Children that are not guilty of sin. And you've got fellows out there with swords. They're crucifying people and some other things. So based on what we find in the scriptures, you know, I'm fairly confident in saying, you know, if there is some kind of counterattack, that it's very difficult. I think most would be on fairly safe ground saying at least that's 99.999% consistent with God's will to stop those that are trying to do evil things to kids. You could tie in, and Jesus wasn't necessarily talking about little children in the sense of 4 and 5 year olds, but young believers when he said, you know, to cause one of the little ones to stumble, you know, to hurt them in some way, better to have the millstone tied around your neck and cast into the sea, and so forth. So, you know, let the little children come unto me, those kinds of things, back there in Matthew chapter 18. So, yes, you do have some wars that have certainly been just, and God's commanding the Israelites to go in and deal with the Amorites and the various otherites in the land, you know, the Canaanites, is helpful information to include as well.
How does that turn the other cheek?
Well, when you deal with turning the other cheek, I would look at that. For example, I know that you're left-handed, right? So this is a little, that's kind of odd to use this illustration on you. But most people are right-handed. I think we agree. All right, if you go back and you look at what Jesus talks about as far as the cheek, if I smack you, let's go back and actually look at that. Let's go back. I believe it's Matthew 5 instead of Matthew 6. It's Matthew 5. Let's start with verse 38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, resist not him that's evil, but whosoever smites you on the right cheek. All right, now, here I am. I'm going to go over, and which side is Ray's right cheek? Is it this one or is it this one? This one closest to you or furthest away? All right, that's going to be his right cheek. But as a right-handed person, if I'm going to hit him, which cheek am I probably going to hit him on? I'm going to hit him on the left. Now, to me, it's significant that Jesus makes that point there as far as actually specifying a cheek. And again, this may go back to, you know, my background. You always have to bear that in mind, that you might be predisposed to a particular view. But unless you're willing to argue that a lot of those Jews were left-handed, which, I mean, you do have some left-handed folks in the Old Testament, but that is set out as, unusual, if you will, which would support what I'm saying. There you have, I think, by the fact that he specifies the right cheek instead of the left. He's not talking about physical assault. He's talking about things which would be disturbing, upsetting, the kind of verbal insults, if you will. There had to be a reason that he specified that cheek. And in my mind, that's consistent with what we discussed. Don?
What position would you take as a Christian in the right to carry? Was he a weapon?
Okay. Let's expand that. You're talking about the right to carry a gun.
Yes,
okay. Okay. There are people in here, including Teresa and I, who are authorized to carry a gun. Okay, Don is, and you know, I think Palmer's are, and Josh is, and well, don't need to raise all the hands. But could you carry a knife? Sure. Could you carry a utility knife? Could a utility knife be an effective weapon? Look at 9/11. What happened? They just had box cutters, and they were able to bring down a plane. Could you carry a baseball bat? Sure. So you might carry those things for a number of reasons. So when you think about concealed carry, if you will, or even open carry, you, in other areas, inherently believe, I think, as far as at least the majority, that those things are not sinful. You know, and with a gun, you might do a variety of things. You know, maybe you have to go out and check out a job site, and you come across a snake. Bang. Take care of him. You know, maybe it's a crazy raccoon. Okay, you know, rather than being bitten by a rabbit, you know, you're not buying that. But, you know, there might be, like I say, some circumstances, and you still come back to the fact that if someone comes against you or comes against your family, are you authorized to defend yourself and your family or not? Now, that's a yes or no question. If you are, then the follow-up question is, how are you authorized to defend them? If you can defend them with a knife, could you defend them with a baseball bat? Well, yes. And if you could defend them with a knife and a baseball bat, could you defend them with a handgun or a shotgun? Yes. So in the question that you asked, I would view that as more your personal choice of a weapon there. You know, again, pepper spray. I don't know. I've never met a Christian, and maybe I've not asked enough, but I've never met a Christian who would object to using pepper spray against someone. Now, they might say, well, there's a difference between pepper spray and a gun. You know, a gun might kill them. Pepper spray is probably going to leave them somewhat incapacitated, but they're going to recover from it. Well, that's certainly true as well.
Perception of a gun is an equalizer. you know, a baseball bat, he may be bigger than you are, yes, or whatever, and I may be more agile than you are.
Yes.
But if you're fairly confident with a gun, you equalize.
Or superiority.
Yes.
I mean, if you know, you're coming at me and you just got brute strength, then you know, I've got a 357 with six rounds. Your strength is probably not going to be any match for six well placed.
They haven't gone. Your other options are going
to. No.
Yeah. So if you authorize personal defense, you then have a difficult time, in my mind, trying to limit it and say, well, what can I do as far as personal defense? Can I hit you once? Can I hit you twice? Can I knock you to your knees? It becomes, I guess, at that point, a matter of degree, how far do you want to go? And that could involve conscience. It troubles me a little bit that, you know, Beth lives in Memphis, and, you know, there's not much there as far as personal protection. That's a dangerous city to live in. But she says, as a Christian, I would not ever, at least at this point in my life, want to take the life of another person. I'm going to have faith in God that he's going to protect me and my family and so forth. If that's your choice, there again, you get into Romans 14, and we're not going to try to force a gun on her or a gun, you know, a carry permit on her. But those are individual decisions that people need to think through. Trace?
She does use a stun gun, though. I mean, she has a stun gun.
Well, yeah, it's like an electric razor, but yeah, it's not exactly a stun gun. So get close enough so I can zap you. So, but there again, you know, you go back to degrees. She's comfortable with that, but not comfortable as far as actually doing something that might take the life. All right. Okay, all right, you had your shot. Let's take a look at Matthew 26 and introduce Matthew 26, verse 26. When we think about memorials created by men, when do people create memorials, before or after the event? After. Think about some of the memorials that have been created. We have memorials for what kinds of things? We've got a memorial for... All right, we've got a memorial, you know, World War I memorial, World War II memorial. Vietnam, you know, a memorial for that. Other memorials might be what?
Any first aid kit.
Well, okay, let's keep with the secular stuff. All right, we've got tragedies like 9/11. What about memorials to presidents? Abe Lincoln was here. Abe Lincoln surveyed this territory and so forth. Now, I can't think, and maybe there is an example, but I can't think of a single memorial which was created in advance of an event. Because for us, that's impossible. How do you forecast something? I mean, it wouldn't make much sense to put up a memorial for World War I before the first shots ever fired. So we know how people use memorials. But when we look at God, we find something that's interesting. And this isn't always true. But you do find multiple examples where God puts a memorial into effect, not after an event, but before. Let's think of a couple examples. Back in Exodus chapter 12, where we have some information about the Passover. Was the Passover, was that annual memorial celebrated before or after? It was celebrated before. How interesting. And then you begin to think about some other things in the Bible. What about Abram? His name was changed to Abraham. Genesis 17, about verse 15, for what reason? He was going to become the father of many nations. He gets the name changed, but when does that promise come true? All right, many years later. Think about Peter. John chapter 1, I believe it's verse 42. Jesus said, your name is going to become Peter, rock. Well, did Peter immediately become a rock? He has some problems. He has some problems at various times, and yet Jesus makes this prediction. So, name changes. Exodus chapter 12, the Passover. And then we come to maybe the greatest example of all, the Lord's Supper. Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper when? Before the cross or after the cross? So God is amazing for a lot of reasons, one of which is this. Now, as we look at the Lord's Supper, and again, a lot of times Matthew 26, 26 to 28 is where we come for this material. We have a lot of descriptions for it. Some of the descriptions are biblical, some are not. Biblical descriptions would include the Lord's Supper. You find that in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20. It is referred to as the breaking of bread in Acts 2, verse 42. You actually have definite articles used there. It is the breaking of the bread in the Greek text in some translations. It is also referred to as the breaking of bread in Acts 20, verse 7. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 16 actually uses the word communion to describe it. We have it referred to in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 21 as eating at the Lord's table. You have the cup referred to as the cup of blessing, 1 Corinthians 10, 16. A few verses later, 1 Corinthians 10:21, it is described as the cup of the Lord. And then there's that well-known description in Matthew 26, verse 29. It is described there as the fruit of the vine. So we have multiple descriptions for it as far as the Bible's concerned. But if you look at people in the religious world, they also have descriptions for it. Descriptions which are not found in or based upon the Bible. One of those descriptions is, remember, it starts with the letter E. They would say this is the Eucharist. Very good. Eucharist is probably based on Eucharisto. That's a Greek word which means to give thanks. So that is definitely a word, but that is not a description that's used in the Bible to describe the Lord's Supper. Liturgy has also been used to describe the Lord's Supper, and that word simply means sacred ministration. It's also not in the Scripture. Does anybody describe the Lord's Supper as a mass or a sacrament? Both are used, and neither one is found in the Scriptures. That would be, I would just sum that up as a celebration of the Lord's Supper.
So when Catholics go to Mass, that means a celebration of the Lord's Supper?
They may have a little bit more involved in it than that, but Mass, as far as just kind of a general description, I would include that in there, yes. Then we also have some other expressions. What about the host? Again, going back to Catholicism, it's an expression or word that's not used there. That word simply means a sacrifice or a victim. One source made this statement, which I think is good. He said the elements for the Lord's Supper are memorials and not sacraments. That's right. Memorials, not sacraments. Okay, let's start with Matthew 26, verse 26. I know this is going to go a little slower than we normally do, but there is a lot of stuff to cover when we deal with the Lord's Supper. So we're going to divide this verse into two sections, but initially we'll read it all. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it. And he gave to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Now, as Matthew says, as they were eating, this is expressed with a present tense, ongoing action. We do know from what we've studied, plus Luke 22, verse 15, a parallel, that this is taking place during the Passover meal. And during this time, Jesus took bread, he blessed it, and broke it. When we think about bread, Ray and I had a conversation about this the other day as far as last Sunday's class. The King James uses the word barrel as far as the water that was poured out on Mount Carmel. We hear words like that, barrel, and we maybe put our own connotation with that word, but we've got to be careful. And here, when we think about bread, what comes to our mind when we think about bread? All right, we go down to Meijer, and you know, we get the Wonder Bread or the Meijer brand, whatever it is, and you know, the Hillbilly Bread, and that's bread. That's probably not what we're dealing with here. This bread was probably very thin bread, unleavened bread. We'll say more about that in just a minute. And I think somewhat similar to what we have as far as what's offered with communion today. People would break it, and one author actually was in Syria, and he described this as thin sheets of bread baked on a hot plate in Syria. And he claims that he broke it the ancient way. Who knows whether or not that's true. Then we have Jesus. He blesses the bread. Now, when you hear that word, you might say, well, I'm not quite sure what that means. There are a couple different words for blessed in the original text, but we don't have to guess about the meaning, whichever word is used. As you look at Matthew 26, verse 26, the word blessed. Do you have an explanation for what that word means in Matthew 26, verse 27? He blessed it. That means he gave thanks. If you like marginal notes, you might make that note in your Bible. What's it mean that he blessed it? He gave thanks. He offered appreciation. This was no special ceremony. These were no, you know, magical words, anything like that. There's no indication here. There's no reference to the denominational practice of somehow consecrating either the bread or the fruit of the vine in the Lord's Supper. And yet you do have, among many religious groups, the idea that when we deal with the Lord's Supper, it somehow becomes holy. The bread ceases to be bread. The fruit of the vine somehow ceases to be the fruit of the vine. And yet, biblically, there's just no support for that. When we were in Fort Wayne, there were some Christians who decided to buy a new building. And they bought a building from a religious group that had some of these unusual ideas about the Lord's Supper. One of the selling points, I guess, that the realtor thought that would help the people who bought the building was there is a special drain for communion. If you don't drink all the juice, then this special drain can be used because in the minds of the former owners, this, of course, was somehow directly associated with Jesus' blood. It was not the product of the grape. Well, if you were not thinking through that very well, you might not get this point, but think through this with me. You create this special drain. Now, how you can do that for a product that you believe is divine. I don't know. But anyway, let's say that you have your special drain built. Where's that going to go to? If you're in the city. It's going to go in the sewer. You would think then that there would have been some kind of special disposal trap that they would have, you know, been able to catch that and so forth, but it just drained out into the city sewer. And I thought, how foolish. You know, why didn't you think that through? I mean, you're just dumping that out into there with things that I'm not going to even venture to suggest what might have been in there. But very, very unusual that they would have come up with that idea. Then you have here the word also that they broke the bread. And there may be some symbolism in that. Why do you think Jesus may have broken the bread? Well, let's give some consideration to what we find over in John 19 about verse 36. You don't have to turn over there unless you want to. But remember, how many bones were broken by Jesus? Or broken on Jesus' body?
Zero.
Zero. And that was a matter of Old Testament prophecy, and that was fulfilled. All right, so if no bones were broken as far as Jesus' body was concerned, why then break the bread when he institutes the Lord's Supper?
Maybe the bread doesn't represent bones, but flesh.
Okay, I think you're on the right...
Flesh was pierced.
Yes, I think you're on the right track. When you think about piercing flesh, it's painful. It's difficult. It is an awful experience. It's something that you really don't want to go through. The body is racked with pain. And we use that word broken. We have a broken man. She's a broken woman. Well, not literally. I mean, they're not literally, you know, snapped like a twig. But we're saying that they're distressed. They've gone through some very difficult times. And maybe Jesus, symbolically, as he breaks that bread, he's saying something's going to happen soon. In less than a day, my body is going to be broken. Not literally, John 19, but it is going to experience some things which are really, really bad. And then, as we think about when this bread was broken, what was the feast that was taking place? Passover. Let's head a couple people back to the Old Testament. Let's go back to Exodus 12. This is, again, all the stuff in that chapter pointing to the Passover feast, helping the people get ready and so forth. Let's see what we find in Exodus chapter 12, verses 8 and 19. And then we also want to have a reference ready from the New Testament. The New Testament verse is going to be Matthew chapter 13, verse 33. Let's pick up our Exodus 12 reference first to find out who wants to read it in a minute. Exodus 12, verses 8 and 19. All right, Betty? And then let's get somebody on deck for our Matthew reference. Matthew chapter 13, verse 33. Matthew 13, 33. All right, Josh. Let's go back to Exodus 12 for a second. Verse 8 and then verse 19. Yeast, or without yeast, is another way of describing what kind of bread? Unleavened bread. So, unleavened, no yeast, same thing. Now, Exodus 12, when the Passover was instituted, did they have yeast? Did they have leaven? Or God said no? No. In fact, he said, if you've got leaven, what's going to happen to you? Cut off. So, I mean, this was a big deal. God said, keep the leaven out of the house. Why do that? Well, the New Testament gives us some information. Now, if you've ever heard someone say, either in a sermon or in a Bible class, that leaven is a symbol for evil in the Bible. Anybody ever hear that? Okay. That is generally true. But that is not always true. So you have to watch those statements. If somebody comes up and says, well, leaven is a symbol for evil, that's too strong. And we know that because of verses like Matthew 13, verse 33.
He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman took and hid in three measures of flour until it was all leavened.
Okay, is the kingdom of heaven a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah.
It's good. And here, what does Jesus compare the kingdom of heaven to? Leaven. Well, if the kingdom of heaven is good, and Jesus compares the kingdom of heaven to leaven, then in Matthew 13, 33, does leaven have a positive connotation or a negative connotation? It's positive. So I would conclude from that that anybody who stands up, and surely they make that statement with good intentions, anyone who proclaims that leaven is always a symbol of evil, they've gone too far. But it is true that leaven is often used to symbolize bad things. For example, Jesus talked about the leaven of the Pharisees, the leaven of the scribes, and so forth. And there are some passages in the Old Testament that also speak of it in a bad way. I also want to head somebody over to the book of Leviticus, chapter 2, verses 11 and 13, for a related thought. And you have a minute to get there. We're going to stop for a second and see if you have any questions. Leviticus 2, 11 and 13. Who wants to take that? Leviticus 2. All right, Lois, verses 11 and 13. Anything that you want to add or ask based on what we've said thus far? Stan?
When it says that Jesus broke the bread, why couldn't it just simply be literal?
Well, I do think it was. I do think he literally broke the bread. But why did he do that? Was there any symbolism there? And that's why I said it may be that he broke that bread to symbolize the fact that he was going to go through some great trials and suffering. You know, his soul was going to be poured out unto death. But yes, he did do that. Why he did it, we don't know for sure, but that is, like I said, one possibility for why that action was done. Okay, let's Lois look at Leviticus 2, verses 11 and 13. Congregations are interesting places for a lot of reasons. In some places, there have been Christians who have said, okay, we get it when it comes to leavened and communion bread, but what about salt? Can we have salted communion bread? Well, that's a good question. That's an important question. And that's why I headed us back to Leviticus 2, where you have some information about grain offerings. Are salt and leaven the same thing? No. Leaven is a fermenting agent. Salt is going to be, we would put that, I think, in the seasoning agent. And there is, as you look at Leviticus 2, 11 and 13, there is a definite distinction between these two things. Not only is there a distinction, God said, deal with these things in two different ways. When it comes to leaven, do what with it? Have it or no? No. But when it comes to salt, have it or no? Yes. So the passage is, I think, helpful in some respects as we look at this. Then you have, and we'll not look at it, but in Exodus chapter 29, verse 2, you have some other items that are specifically mentioned. And we don't have a lot of information about the communion bread as far as what it might be made of. Leaven, I would suggest that we've got enough information there to say that that is definitely out. But when you look at some other things, for example, salt, you look at honey and some other items, I can find no basis which says that those things cannot be used in the construction or the creation of the Lord's Supper. And yet sometimes I think Christians are hesitant to have bread that tastes good. You know, the idea is if it tastes bad, it's got to be right. Well, you don't find that in the Scriptures. If you've got bread, which has, I mean, it might be foul-tasting bread because, you know, either the bakery messed it up or maybe somebody overcooked it or something like that. But as long as you've got bread that is unleavened bread, that, as far as I can tell, is the key item in the Lord's Supper. So if you've ever wondered about communion bread, unless somebody knows something I don't, no leaven. If it shows with honey or some other things in it, I'm willing to affirm that you're on good ground. Thoughts on that or questions?
I didn't quite understand. You said that's okay?
What's that?
Honey and salt okay?
Yeah. Okay. Well, if that's mixed in, I'm not talking about, you know, you get up there and let's drape it with honey. But I'm talking about in the construction, in the creation of the bread. As if you were looking at the ingredients.
The only thing you want to is don't have any leaven in it. You use it.
Well, I'm hesitant to sometimes word things in certain ways, so saying just do anything you want to, I'm not sure I would express it in that way. But as far as the ingredients, you want to make sure that you do not have leaven in it. I'm going to leave it at that.
Not with the bread.
Now that's a new one on me.
Vitamin
C. He's been in some congregations where if the fruit of the vine had vitamin C, it was a no-go. I've heard of some interesting things, but that is a new one on me. So we'll just kind of get to that partially tonight and partially a little later. But anyway, thank you for that. Anybody else?
Question, I understand the question, but in the wintertime when you have communicable diseases, can't be broken. It's already broken apart.
I would answer that question in the same way that I answered before. If you've got unleavened bread, you know, Jesus broke that for some reason. You know, maybe there was a need. Maybe it passed quicker. We're not told exactly why. Maybe he wanted to have that symbolism that we talked about. There could be multiple reasons for that. There's kind of a related question about the cup, which we'll get into as well. When you look at information in the Bible, you need to make sure that when you find details, those details fall into the category that it's a binding detail instead of a fact. For example, in Acts chapter 20, you find some people meeting in an upper room. Would we conclude from that example that we have to meet in an upper room? Well, most people would probably say no. And some of this is determined as far as a correct conclusion by looking at other passages. Some of it involves common sense. And here, I think we use a little common sense in Matthew chapter 26. If we break the bread, or if we receive a piece of bread and we don't break it, if it's not broken, are we still observing the Lord's Supper? You say no.
Rephrase it.
Okay. All right. Since you brought it up, let's use you and I. I receive a piece of bread that I can break. It's big enough for that. You receive a piece of bread that's really not big enough to break. I mean, you just have to take a hammer practically and hit it a time or two so it would break and you could actually have some pieces. So I break it. You have a piece which is too small not to break. Would we both be observing the Lord's Supper or not? I don't think anybody would deny that we are. Now, I might be observing it with a bigger piece that's broken, but again, you could make a similar argument with the cup. You know, I drain the cup, Don doesn't. Have we both partaken of the Lord's Supper as far as that aspect of it? Yes. So you get into those details, for example, and you're, in my mind, dealing with some things that go beyond what Christ is trying to teach there. Okay.
We have been places where Dan remembers this or not, but there were people who did not think it was proper and correct unless they were able to break it. They did not like the little pieces that are already broken apart. And so they felt like they were not really doing it without actually breaking the bread. So there are some people who feel very strongly about
yeah, and like I say, this is where you get into a lot of things in Matthew chapter 26, and you know, because I don't know who has heard what and may think what, we're going to try to work through a lot of these questions, so just try to bear patiently through some of this material. And in that particular case, you have...
They did not bind that on anybody
else.
They just wanted a piece that they could break.
Right. In that case, you have a situation which is like Romans 14. And you can provide enough bread where if people want to break it, they can. I raised, not here, but in a Bible class setting one time, could we, and there was a lady, she about came off a rocker at the age of 90. I said, could we, theoretically at least, have the Lord's Supper? We're doing all the right stuff, but we have the fruit of the vine before the bread. Well, she'd never thought about that before. And she kind of came unglued. Are you teaching that? I said, no. But I do want us to consider the fact that we don't get caught up here in some of the details to the point. You know, for example, how many cups do we have? And do we have to break the bread? And, you know, can we have salt? And those kinds of things. Where we miss the main point. And yet, people sometimes do that. Do we have to drink? And we'll discuss this a little later as well, maybe not tonight. But do we have to drink every drop out of the cup, almost taking our tongue and licking it out so there's none left? Or are we able to leave a little bit in the cup? If a person is allergic to grape juice, could we water down the grape juice, if you will? So there are all kinds of questions that come up, even the vitamin C question. Okay.
Do you think if Jesus was Asian, he would have been the rice of life instead of the bread of life?
Well, when you look at bread in the Old Testament, you think about the manna from heaven that came down. It wasn't rice. It was bread. So
that's
when,
because he was Mediterranean and not Asian, right? And if he was Mexican, would he have been the tortilla?
Well, I'm no culinary expert, but I think when you look at bread, I'd put that in the tortilla category. But God chose certain symbols and certain foods and items to symbolize some things. Now, had rice been a fitting symbol, you know, for the people in that country, You know, he may have chosen that Jesus is the rice of life. I'm not sure. I'd have to do some looking as far as if you look at all the countries in the world and you see how popular rice is compared to bread, which one is going to be more universal? Now, if I just had to make an off-the-cuff guess, I would guess that bread is probably going to be more universal than rice. I don't know that. I could be wrong. But if that's true, where that is going to be more universal than others, then that would have been, as far as using that symbol, a more comprehensive way to describe Jesus.
I had a bread. I was in Asia staying with this person that had a bread-making machine, so this yeast thing was really making sense to me. And then I took some bread over to some people that don't eat bread. They just eat rice. Wow, they have no clue about how yeast works.
Well, and like I say, you know, God worked with people in a certain culture. There were some things the Jews received, like I say, instruction in captivity. There were some things in Egypt that happened, and he prepared them, and ultimately the world for that, and used symbols that were best and the most appropriate for that. And had rice been appropriate for that, then he certainly could have gone that way and surely would have. But the people that you took the bread to, did they have the ability to get bread, or was rice their only food? Do you remember?
Probably rice was their only food.
Was it? Okay. And there are, I mean, rice is usually cheap.
I mean, like, they could get bread and packaged bread.
Okay, so even there it was available.
They knew what bread was.
Yeah. Okay, all right. You know, it's usually pretty cheap, widely available. I mean, rice, you know, also cheap, fairly readily available. It's pretty good as far as filling people up. But, you know, God did choose to send manna from heaven instead of rice.
And when he said bread of the world, he meant I'm your food.
Yes, spiritual food. So it was an ideal illustration for the people. You know, even for us, you know, if we think about prisoners or we think about soldiers being on strict rations, what do we say? You're going to get rice and water? You're going to get bread and water. And I'd have to go back and look at that expression and see exactly the etymology of it and see why people came up with it. But I think that's kind of interesting that it's not something like rice and water, some other product. But bread is that universal thing, it seems like.
You can explain it to people that, yeah, he's the food, just like to you it means he's the rice of life.
Yeah. Well, right, it's the staple. Yes.
Some people get very legalistic, though, and say, no, you can't say that.
Yeah. But you're trying to convey, and Jesus talked about living water. Again, people need water. He could have said, you know, I'm the living Kool-Aid. Well, that probably wouldn't have been the best choice, or I'm the living lemonade, those kinds of things. But he pulled out something which was common. You think, for example, about Abraham and Sarah. The three men come to them, and cakes were prepared, which, there again, you're kind of in the bread category instead of the rice category. So it was very, very common in ancient times. Okay. Anybody have a minute question? I've still got, believe it or not, a little bit more to say about Matthew 26:26, the end of the verse.